If we get to other planets, as we may someday, it's not at all impossible. We are going to find, however, that intuitively and psychically we have a cord with all beings on other planets. I think this idea of a malignant race somewhere in space waiting to conquer the Earth is in the world of science fiction. Actually, man's sixth and seventh sensory perception must be held in common with the equivalent on all other planets of the solar system. Every planet may develop a kind of life which has sensory manifestations of its own, and they may be entirely different from ours. These beings may have the equivalent of five sensory perceptions. If they are comparatively young, they may not have individualized as many to the same degree that we have. If they are more advanced, they will have individualized them perhaps past anything we have achieved. But these sensory perceptions, such as we call sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell, these perceptions or their equivalents, according to the conditions of the different planetary environments, will be developed individually by the creatures inhabiting these. As a result, they may have achieved a great nobility, or they may have failed to achieve a high culture. Perhaps they will not even be visible to us, not having the kind of bodies that we know or can capture in our vibratory sensory perceptions. But the two higher faculties which all beings within a solar system must possess to complete the septenary, the two higher faculties are still unindividualized. Therefore, they still belong to the solar body. And because they belong to the solar body, they are a reservoir of common insight. And any creature extending its consciousness above the fifth sensory perception will have some common communion with any other creature that does the same thing, because these sensory perceptions are not divided. Therefore, if we wish to assume that the sixth sensory perception is a kind of psychic clairvoyance in qualities, extending beyond our present knowledge, perhaps a conscious apperception or experience of causations, then any creature that reaches this peculiar degree or level of intuitive insight will share it with all other creatures possessing the same insight. In other words, with any creature that passes beyond the fifth sensory perception. Now, the same thing is true of religions. For actually, religions arise in two ways. In substance and essence, they arise from the solar energy itself. By interpretation, they arise from the individualization of man. And this is a point that has also been confused in Buddhism by non-believers. They do not realize the double causation of things, namely the things arising in their own natures, and these same things taking form and unfolding through the mental limitations of human beings. So in the ascent of religions to a certain degree, through what you might term the nominal religious beliefs of man, you are going to have different faiths. But these different faiths are going to move closer together. But when you get to mysticism, you find that it is a faith in common of all men. And when you get beyond that to the highest levels of esotericism, you find there is no conceivable difference in religious conviction. Thus we have in all these different areas, we have five differentiated elements following the old order of earth, fire, air, water, and ether. We also have five differentiated elements recognized in China. They are slightly different from ours, but constitute the same gamut. Then we have two unrecognized basic elements. And these two also constitute, finally, the highest environmental factors holding forms, bodies, and structures together. They are the great cohesives. We have five recognized ether factors, so-called hypothetical, but actually real. We also have two higher forms of etheric integrations, which bind things together rather than binding together the parts of single things. Thus, in the solar system, we have a very elaborate and very useful purpose in the unfoldment and perfection of life. It has been noted from the beginning also that the processions of planets, the motions of seasons, and all the other phenomena that we know have together constituted religious ritual. We know that the High Mass is a solar ritual. We know that practically every part of the religious symbolism of mankind relates to the parts of the solar system and their rhythms and relations with each other. It was only in comparatively a short time ago, however, a few centuries, that Kepler made one of his most vital discoveries. The solar system, being like an alchemical retort, containing within itself the power of the sun, which holds only the power to manifest certain principles from within itself, gradually becomes the environment of an infinite diversity. The Pythagoreans declared that this diversity was included within unity, and unity itself was never divided, the unity representing the wall pass not that completely envelops the solar system as the shell of an egg or as the surface of a bubble. But now comes the problem. How out of the regularity and inevitability of these processes can what we call difference come into existence? How, for example, to approach it from an Aristotelian point of view, how can that which is the same cause difference? And if we wish to point out the religious factor, that which is the same is God. Therefore, how can that which is the same become conditioned? How can deity, for example, produce the state of not deity? How can infinite good, which is deity, produce the phenomena of that which is not good? How can an eternal, benevolent God permit evil? This is an interesting and very tricky subject. But perhaps, as Kepler points out, the solar system is the secret, for within its processes we discover the laws by means of which that which is the same can be different. The answer lies, of course, in the motions of planets. Not that the motions of planets constitute in themselves this difference, but by another subtle factor, which Pythagoras also pointed out, namely that the power of planets is not in their bodies, but in their intervals. That it is the space between them that determines their power, not the bodies themselves. So here we have, for example, seven powers represented in ancient times by the planetary deities. In the astrotheology of the ancients, these seven powers were fixed. they were manifestations of the power of the solar logos. There was nothing that they possessed that was different from what he possessed. He was not deficient in anything that they could contribute. They remained as they were, each a manifestation of one phase of the divine nature. None could be better or worse than their natural endowment. None could be more or less than that which was their own nature. Therefore, even though they moved and fluttered in space or went whirling around their orbits forever, they could cause, by the more common thinking, no difference, because it made no difference how they moved or where they moved. Their natures did not change. And if their natures did not change, then in the common thinking of man, there could be no difference or separateness set up by them. But what happened, as Kepler found, was that things, the natures of which do not change, produce difference by their relationships with each other. The things themselves do not change, but the angles of incidence of energy motion and the directions of motions do change. Therefore, if two of these bodies came into a relationship of a 90-degree angle of the meeting of their rays, this relationship was different in quality from a conjunction of these two bodies or an opposition of these two bodies in which their rays met at an angle of 180 degrees, which was merely to oppose one with the other. Consequently, all relationships were due to these movements of similars, in which things never changing of their own nature create immutable and inevitable change by their relationship. A very simple example of that, which we all can recognize, is the fact that the seasonal changes of the earth, winter, spring, summer, and fall, do not mean that there is any change actually in the structure of the sun or in the structure of the earth, nor is there any essential difference in the amount of energy which the sun bestows. But the angle of incidence of the rays of the sun striking the earth will produce the differences of season simply because of the inclination of the earth's axis. Yet nothing is substantially changed, only changed by relation of incident. Consequently, the entire universe, solar systems, cosmic systems, space itself, is subject to an infinite diversity of manifestation simply due to this relationship of unchanging parts. By this relationship, all things become differentiated. More forms of life become differentiated than it is possible for us to even imagine. Yet this differentiation in itself is no evidence that anything becomes better or worse. It simply represents difference. This led to certain moral speculations concerning existence. And it points out to us very clearly that all natures have within them essentially the same substances. But conditions due to relationships release what appear to be individualities. This, again, is a good psychological point. For actually, it is relationship, association, and use that determines the development of the differences in human personalities, not a difference in the essential life energy involved. In the Eastern religions and philosophies particularly, the solar system, of course, becomes part of the range of mental phenomena. This means, however, something which I think we have to bear a little thought for, because we are interested in both Eastern and Western philosophy. The idea that some people have that certain Eastern schools simply regard the universe as an illusion, this attitude is for the most part wrong. The ancients, and particularly the Oriental peoples, did not hold that the solar system had no existence. They did not believe that the cosmic systems had no existence. Nearly all of the Eastern systems arise from the philosophies of India. And these philosophies did not deny physical phenomena. Nor did they say when a man sat down on a chair that neither the man nor the chair could be there. Actually, this was an exaggeration arising in the minds of interpreters trying to make an absurdity out of a situation that is basically rather sound. The Eastern position on the matter is this. You stand at a certain point, we will say, on the earth, and you look out into the rest of the solar system and perhaps through and beyond it to the regions of the stars. And you look out and you say to yourself, what do these things mean? How are we to interpret the essential natures of these powers? And Eastern philosophy says that with a very limited area of experience at our disposal, that most of this mystery simply cannot be experienced. We can observe it, we can feel it, but we cannot participate in it. We can have a certain pleasant emotional experience of being out under the stars at night and sensing the magnitude of it all. But the solar system, or even the planet itself, cannot be experienced by man. He can only be an observer of it. He can only look at it with wonder and be profoundly influenced in his thinking by the strange regularities which he beholds. But it is because he cannot experience it that he is capable of massing evidence about it into two distinct schools. He is able to mass one group of evidence on the level of material science and insist that all he is looking at is a vast machine. He is able to gather evidence or amass conviction on another side of the question, in which he is convinced that the entire mystery of solar existence is held in the hand of an eternal God. He can see these things as physical processes if he is a physical thinker, psychic processes if he is a psychologist, philosophical processes if he is a philosopher, divine processes if he is a theist. Each one in his own level interprets, but he is interpreting from his own level of insight. And he has no true evidence, as Buddha points out, that any of these levels of insight is adequate. He has no way of knowing. He is willing to argue to the end of time in the defense of his own position, but he is not sure of any part of it. He is not assured of the faculties or the powers with which he estimates these things. Therefore, it is really practically impossible for him to do more than to present or preserve or transmit the great traditional concepts which have descended to him from his ancestors, from the great schools of the past. Why do we find in the majority of instances that these traditional instincts or these traditional attitudes are apparently more idealistic than the more recent ones? Why does it seem as though man is forever declining into materiality? why is it that the creativity of his race, the creativity of his culture, is always remote? And in the course of history, it would seem that he is forever losing ground. The answer to this probably lies in the fact that the differentiation of human sensory perceptions, the rise of the five senses, sustained by their etheric elemental counterparts, as these have grown more and more powerful, they have led to greater and greater individualization. The five senses have blocked out the superior sensory perceptions. They have obscured them. As the Tibetan says, the eye of the sage has been closed, and in its place are the two eyes that see the world. In the ancient philosophies, the mysterious spiritual eyes in the brain were believed to be active, which is no longer the case. In the development of the relationship between man and his planet, and man's growth on the planet, and his gradual adjustment to the external environment of the planet, from all these we see that man, indoctrinated through his sensory perception, has become more and more aware of physical things, and less aware of their causes. He has also gradually become less interested in causes, simply because he senses the frustration of trying to find them. Somewhere along the line, probably everyone makes two or three stabs in the dark towards some more enlightened point of view, but finding nothing but resistance or a static, non-reaction from space around him, he retires finally to lick his wounds and remain in his materialistic concepts. But in the remote time of things, man moved from an internal to an external state. And this also is related to the development of the planet. According to the ancient tradition, the planet developed like the fertilized cell of the human being by developing a polar cap, or a gradual descent of crystallization from the north polar extremity of the cell. This crystallization resulted in the emergence of what the ancients called the imperishable land, or the imperishable island. And gradually the development of this planetary form made it increasingly suitable for the embodiment of beings or entities that had previously been suspended in the seven orbits, or seven conditions of the invisible body of the Earth. The Earth entity taking form, coming into manifestation within the solar system, as the Earth entity unfolded, the lives which it carried with it began to unfold also, as in the case of the embryo, where the embryo, having once begun to manifest, seems to bring into manifestation an ever greater number of cellular lives and structures to become its new body. The earth, according to the ancients, as it unfolded, caused these various orders of life to come into embodiment, or come into incarnation. And because five have been individualized, five have come into life. And this is what we see in our experiences today. Actually, beyond this point, the evolution of these different forms of life reveal different degrees, we will say, of superior insight. In the earliest days, these forms coming into manifestation still shared a degree of the sixth and seventh power in common, or the solar intuitive insight. these beings were aware of the archetype, and they imprinted this archetype on their most primitive institutions. They first intuitively and instinctively, and probably without conscious intent, simply lived according to the archetype. As the patterns of the archetype grew dimmer within themselves, they then had dependence upon the forms which they had already built, as though at some very remote time they had fashioned a beautiful vessel of clay, simply because they had a tremendous insight into beauty. Gradually this insight faded away, but the vessel of clay remained, and they were able to copy it indefinitely from that time on, making a vast number of reproductions of it. These reproductions, however, drifted further and further away from the original design because they had lost consciousness of the original design and were merely reproducing something that had already existed. Man, becoming more and more absorbed in material forms, follows this process of infinitely reproducing old concepts, but having lost the meaning of them. Thus we have an age of fable that descends to us, with the legends preserved and the meanings lost. Thus we have great archetypal arts, which were originally vast spiritual sciences, but now they have descended to us merely as physical arts and sciences, with their true meanings lost. In the background of all knowledge, therefore, is this lostness which results from embodiment. And this lostness is the result of involution, or the descent of life into form. The regaining of the lost insight is evolution, or the rescuing of consciousness through form. The belief of the ancients was that solar systems come into existence and go out of existence like any other type of body in space. Just as surely as the human being, completing a life cycle, retires from visibility, only to remain for a time in abscondito and then to come forth again in a new body, so solar systems likewise go to sleep, carrying with them their natural karma, which they have on their own level of function. After a certain time, the solar system is born again in the same way that we described at the beginning of the talk. It receives its allotment and emerges. In the meantime, it remains in suspension, in seed form, through the nights of the solar rest, the great pralaya between embodiments. This brings up another interesting point, and that is that while these various degrees of life are locked in their potential seed forms, represented in Buddhism by placing a luminous pearl upon a lotus flower, and then placing in the pearl a character of the Sanskrit language, this is called the seed form. It is the vibration pattern, by means of which the power will be caused to emerge from sleep. When the time comes for this seed to open, it becomes then obvious that all the different kinds of seeds floating in space appear the same while they are in seed form. But when they begin to awaken, they all awaken according to the inherent degree of their previous existence. Consequently, while lives may not appear to differ at some stage in their growth, as it is true that in the early degrees of fetal development, it is almost impossible to tell the human fetus from that of a chicken or some quadruped. After a certain time, however, the differentiating characteristics appear. After a certain time, the chicken comes out of the shell, but the human fetus remains much longer to gain greater evolutionary prenatal growth. Thus, in space, all of these different levels exist, levels of growth. some forms can never unfold at this time or in this degree of their life beyond an atomic pattern. Others can develop into cellular forms. Some can develop into complicated cellular structures like the radiolaria. Some have a more potential and will become animate things. These in turn divide into all kinds of kingdoms, species, and genera. Finally, some of these, which could not be distinguished from the others at the beginning, become human. Then there are other seeds in this space which evolve without our ever knowing what the final pattern may be. There are seeds that are growing now that will not reach their maturity until after man has ceased to be on the earth. There are also seeds of other substances, and science is beginning to suspect this, which are growing invisibly around us all the time and are actually creating worlds just as well integrated and organized as our own, but entirely beyond our perception. Thus, it is perfectly possible for many different patterns to grow up in space. This growth always being the unfoldment of the potential that is carried in the seeds. The sun, of course, is an example of such a seed. A planet is also an example of such a seed, and so is man. And each one of these seeds will continue to grow, and through the association of karma, will gradually unfold greater and greater potentials. But the transference from one kingdom to another, or a major step forward, will only take place during the period of rest, or the pralaya between creations. At the moment, one of our greatest and most interesting subjects is the study of the moon. Represented in ancient art, as they say, the mad mother of the earth. The actual relationship of the moon to the earth in the Eastern philosophy is that it is the previous body of the earth entity. The moon is therefore a corpse. The moon is a body disintegrating in space. And the life wave that belonged to it and once needed it has evolved to become the earth humanity. The moon, therefore, is a shell, a ghost, like one of the doppelgangers of ancient Teutonic legendary and lore. This does not mean that the moon is totally dead, any more than a corpse is totally dead. It does mean, however, that the type of life in the corpse or in the moon is residual. It is that which belongs to the smaller organisms or parts from which the major life-giving principle has been removed. The decay of a dead body is an evidence of life, but it is a gradual release of living things from a pattern. And because they are released from the pattern, they gradually become destroyed by lack of the central nutritional power which holds things together. So the moon has its own sub-life, but it does not possess a major evolving life such as we know. While we are discovering its craters and its well-pucked surface, actually we have learned nothing from this recent exploration of the subject that was not philosophically known thousands of years ago. And except for a few completely fictional approaches, no one of serious mind in philosophy has had any idea other than that of the ancient Hindus that the moon was gradually disintegrating. It was like a ghost in a graveyard. It was perhaps a little more tangible or physical than the common ghost that we see, but still it is only a shadow. It is only a remainder, which can never again be re-ensouled any more than the mummified body of an Egyptian pharaoh. The energies of the moon, however, are very interesting, because man in his own psychic integration also has a lunar antibody in his own magnetic field. The moon plays a part in the life of things. It isn't a total loss by any means. The moon radiates certain kinds of energy. And the energy of the sun striking the moon and reflected to the earth mingles in psychic chemistry with the direct ray of the sun, forming a peculiar chemical situation on the earth itself. Also, the etheric double of the moon, which is only a phase of its physical body, and like the spook, is also an empty shell. The etheric double of the moon is very important in connection with physical generation. It provides certain elements necessary for the creation of bodies. These elements being particularly the etheric field, which holds particles of matter together and also provides the link binding consciousness to form. The moon plays an important relation part in these things. The moon also, because of its tremendous influence upon tidal motions and upon the fluids of things, is the most dominant factor in the etheric body of the earth. It is this, the lunar motions, working through the etheric field that disturbs substances in the magnetic field of man, producing certain phenomena which is intensified at eclipses and at new moons, also producing a kind of phenomena that by disturbing the etheric fluid balance of the human body is associated with outbreaks of mental disease. It is deeply involved in the problem of contagion and infection, which are themselves due to the debilities of the etheric double. And, of course, we know that the moon is involved in the menstruational cycle. These all have to do with the effect upon the etheric double of man, which is the problem involved, because the moon determines the day and night of ether, of the etheric double, as the sun determines the day and night of the physical body. Therefore, it is the moon that determines the cycles of fertility and sterility in the life of all creatures on the earth. The moon also has to do with the psychic field of man in its effect upon imagination. And the imaginative faculties of the mind are to a degree due to the influence of the moon upon the etheric fluids that support both the brain and the mind. Therefore, actually, the effect of the moon is that of push and pull, a gravitational effect creating an imbalance in the magnetic field. Each planet has moons. Some have more than one. In some, however, the moons have disintegrated until only their etheric doubles still exist. When a moon is completely removed, or when a planet loses the last of its moons, and there is no further disturbance of this kind, it means that almost certainly that particular planet has outgrown its etheric inconstancy. Where the moons disappear, the duration of the physical life upon a planet is greater. When the moons disappear, most of the tensions and psychic pressures of a planet are reduced. And if we are to assume that somewhere there is a place where things are immortal, it must be where the power of the moon has been done away with, because the moon is associated closely with mortality. There's one other point we'd like to mention, and that is the rings of Saturn. These were known at a very early time in human experience. The rings of Saturn represent a link between the solar system and that which lies outside of the globe or area set aside for the manifestation of the solar logos. The planet Saturn is a chemically psychic thing which suggests almost nirvana. For the rings are really, according to the ancients, were the bands of ever more subtle vibrations through which entities or beings pass when they escape from the solar system. Therefore, the rings absorb all of the forms of life in the orbits of the other planets, and that which is useless is cast into chaos by the rings of Saturn, and that which has the great spiritual power, or that which has the great evolutionary trend perfected within it, is released through the rings of Saturn into a developed consciousness beyond that which we know here. Therefore, the rings of Saturn bring the solar system into objectivity and reabsorb it again into subjectivity. When Saturn eats all his children, the elements of the solar system, the assimilation and excretion of this procedure is through the rings. And most ancient peoples were very much aware that the rings represented the final breakdown of all things that have to do with mortality, and that the final vestiges of matter are broken up and scattered in space through the rings of Saturn. These rings also form the link between this solar system and the next superior order of life. So with thousands of years of thought and study and a vast amount of interpretation of these matters, the ancients came to some interesting thoughts on this subject, thoughts that can also be adapted to other areas of interest. And while we might not really feel that their position was entirely sound astronomically, let us realize that this wasn't their problem. Their primary problem was the psychology of the universe. Their primary problem was the relationship between creation and mental phenomena. And most of all, the relationship as experienced in the consciousness of man between the human being and the vast evolving patterns of space. Thus, while geocentric astronomy is no longer regarded as accurate astronomically and physically, there is much to indicate that geocentric astronomy is very accurate psychologically, because it deals primarily with levels of qualities, with processes taking place in the invisible psychic structure of things, and not merely the physical processes with which we are acquainted. The physical processes of generation and corruption of life, which we see, is only one aspect. For while this is taking place, while man seems to be going down to the grave, man and the universe are moving upward toward another destiny. And in one level, the energy seemed to be classified in a physical pattern. But in the great level of things, the psychological pattern seems to be archetypally similar to the old, arbitrary, psychically revealed structure of the universe. And it is in this older structure that we must seek man's original insight and try to understand how his psychic nature is best represented by one pattern, even though this pattern is inconsistent with known physical scientific formulas. If we can combine these different elements, I think we will gain something of interest. Well, I guess time is up, so we'll see you next week. Continue with this arbitrary rambling.